responsibility is the inmate health care. That unit was overseen by our Division of Institutions. We determined that it needed to be moved under his area of responsibility simply because it's involved in so much contracting and there's so much discussion all the time on cost containment and cost of care. And those are some, it's a large area of our budget that Mr. Burnett is going to attempt to get under control. As you heard from Commissioner Gilbertson, this is an area that's just spiraling out of control in a number of different departments that have health care responsibilities as part of their duties. And so we're going to engage in some attempts to manage that in our department. The two big operational divisions fall directly into the responsibility of the Deputy Commissioner. Well, the first of those appears on page 2. It's the Division of Institutions. We operate 13 plus or minus, depending on how you define them, facilities directly in the state of Alaska. I've got them listed here. Just for your information, I thought it might be helpful to put some cost of care figures on there. You'll see some widely varying costs, and those are due to a number of different factors. We have larger facilities are cheaper to house people in. However, sometimes the mission can get in the way of lowering that cost of care. Booking facilities, for example, are much more expensive to operate than long-term care facilities simply because we have to do health care assessments and mental health assessments. The medical costs associated with new prisoners that come in that have got heavy-duty health problems need to be assessed at the time of booking before they move out to a longer-term care facility. So that's part of the reason for some of those differences in costs. Also, too, just the location. It's more expensive to feed somebody in Bethel than it is in Palmer. So our system takes all that into account.
Why, just a real brief question here. Why is the Palmer Correctional Center so much cheaper than everybody else?
Well, first of all, Mr. Chairman, it's a medium to minimum custody facility, so the facility itself is just cheaper to run. It doesn't have the all the maintenance associated, for example, with the heavy high custody doors and operating mechanisms. Prisoners open and close their own cell doors. That's unique when you look at a facility like Spring Creek, for example, where all those things have automated systems on them, and those all require maintenance and electricity to operate. Also, too, it's actually a fairly large facility. We, we house, like 300, I want to say 375, 400 there at any given time. But at any rate, it's 76
just plus over 400.
Yeah, just over 400. So that allows us to bring our per cost meals down and the cost of pay per meal down and realize some economies in laundry, that kind of thing.
Is your cost without programs, does it deal with everything else though besides programs, maintenance and that sort of thing, capital?
Well, the capital, there's actually some, we're trying to get an accurate figure. We get asked that quite a bit in discussions, particularly with privatization, when that comes up on the table, exactly what our capitalization costs are. And we're going to develop those figures for you so we can adequately present that when the discussion comes up again.
The only facility that I don't see here that may be of interest to us is the cost in Arizona. Do you have a basic number for those?
It runs about $54 a day plus some associated, the program costs take it to about $64 to $65 a day.
And does that include travel, bringing the prisoner from Alaska to Arizona and back?
We believe that that does not cover that. That's
and we're working on final figures.
Yeah. Below that area, we have most, if not all, of our facilities. Many of our facilities. Mostly, we offer adult basic education programs. We offer the ability or access to get to provide our prisoners with a general education diploma, GED. At Spring Creek, we have what is known as the Youth Offender Program. It's a federal grant that's operated in conjunction with the Kenai School District with high-risk youth offenders that don't have high school diplomas. We've got a special housing unit there designated that they go to. Most of our facilities offer substance abuse programs in one form or another. We have specialized sexual offender treatment programs. the main actual treatment program is at Highland Mountain Correctional Center outside of Anchorage. We have an education program that operates here at Lemon Creek in Juneau. Many of our facilities have anger management and batterers programs, and then we have a variety of vocational and technical programs that are offered depending on which facility. That would include the prison industries programs and then some basic maintenance type programs that are offered. Last in that section, what they've called the Community Jails Initiative. We're getting a booklet printed up, and I apologize for not having it ready to go right now for you to review. The Community Jails Initiative is a program that passes money through the Department of Corrections to local police departments to operate local lockups, if you will, under contract to the state. We basically reimburse these local police departments to house prisoners that are charged with state offenses, violations of the state criminal code. That program this year is budgeted for $4.8 million, and I think you'll find the booklet that we will be generating soon to very illustrative in exactly how the program works. Some debate surrounds that. Many of the communities in your various districts will tell you, though, that this program is really essential to keep 24-hour police protection operating in many of these smaller towns. Whereas the way the money works in some of our smaller communities is it keeps dispatch centers, for example, operating 24 hours. So residents in the community have got a number that they can call a 911 service. The dispatcher also has the duty then of overseeing the jail and making sure that the prisoners are supervised on a 24-hour basis. So that's kind of how that program works. We took it over from, well, we used to run the program, I'm told, long before I started with the department. Then we gave the program, it was transferred over to public safety, and then we recently took it back in the mid to early 90s. So we've had it since then.
Just a second, Mark, we've got a couple of legislators that want to talk to you. Representative Samuels.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the inmate programs that you've got, Commissioner, what's the timeline on finishing audits, and how much back information do you have on recidivism rates to see the effectiveness of the programs that you've got in place, everything from the DED to the sex offender to the vocational, the whole gamut?
Well, you're asking a big question, through the chair. We're doing audits. We're trying to get these audits done as best we can. Our auditor has been... the first program we have her scheduled to audit is the sex offender treatment program in Highland Mountain. And then she'll spread out and hit these other programs from there. As far as recidivism tied to the individual programs, with regard to the programs that are aimed at negative behavior, that's something we want to know, and sadly I'm not able to really provide you with very much information. Which is surprising to me, but I'm sorry to have to report that to you. With the programs like education, well, our education programs, I'm not sure that anybody has actually tried to ever even, has even thought about trying to tie recidivism rates to whether someone has a GED. Again, I'm sorry to say that's, because I think there probably is a correlation there. We just haven't asked the question. We hope to develop answers to both those questions as quickly as we can. That's one of the things I intend to do, is to try and look at all of our programs from that way, and it seems that it would be obvious that had been done, but we get into a lot of definitional problems on what is recidivism, for example. It seems like a fairly simple concept to try and develop, but as I think I was talking to you in your office the other day, this is one of those things that isn't as easy as it seems, because everybody has a different definition of what recidivism is. Some people would prefer that you have a very, what's called a narrow definition of recidivism, that basically if a person goes through a program and doesn't get out, or and gets out and does not come back for 2 months, then the program is a success. I think most people, when they talk about this, would prefer to use something a little broader, maybe 6 months or a year. But that's a point that we've got to settle and then move on from there.
Or two or three.
Or two or three, right, exactly.
Follow up?
Nope. Ms. Stoltz?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How is the, this appears to be a decline in the amount of dividends in your ability to use that as a source, how is that impacting your department? And
well, sure. Mr. Burnett, do you have an answer there?
I can't answer that question yet. I think we can, we'll be able to answer it as we go through the budget process, but at this point, it will definitely have an effect on our budget, as it will have an effect on public safety and law's budget.
Well, yes, sir, on another subject, on the newly created Office of Victims' Rights, are you, as Commissioner, are you aware of their existence, and what are programs and policy in place do you have to interact with them to make sure proper notification and the other mandates are carried out?
Well, through the chair, yes, we're very aware of Mr. Branch Flower's program. We have a victims' rights coordinator currently in the department. We do a number of activities associated with that. One of the more interesting things we do is something called the BIND system, which is an automated notification system that has been very, very well received by the public. It allows people to call in. If you're concerned about a particular prisoner, you can call in and get information about them in any of a number of ways, simply by typing in their last name or their prisoner ID number, if you know what that is. And you can get you can be apprised of whether they're in or out and some other information. And we encourage also the public just to call our facilities, and we freely give out the status of court cases and what's going on.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Jewell. Of these inmate programs, which of these are court ordered?
Well, through the chair, generally what you'll see is that oftentimes programs in the substance abuse area and the sex offender treatment area, as well as anger management and battery, will be ordered alternately depending on the offenses involved with the individual prisoner.
And a follow-up to that, as a result of having gone through that, while they might be court-ordered, I don't know if they're really, that the inmates have to take them, but of those that do, is there a correlating recidivism number out there?
Well, through the chair again, and I can tell you anecdotally, as someone who's been in the business for quite a while, there's almost everybody recidivates. I mean, I can just tell you that. I think Mr. Tupou has been a probation officer for a long time in our system, there's a level of recidivism. What that level of recidivism is in terms of a number, in terms of how successful it is for preventing people from relapsing, I can't tell you that right now. Because it really depends. We have to have internal discussions and decide what it is we're going to call recidivism, and set that date, and then measure everything that happens in terms of that time period. I can tell you that as a longtime corrections employee, I've seen people that have gone through all of our substance abuse phase 1, 2s, and 3s, and they keep coming back. That is disturbing to me, and that's part of what I hope to accomplish as commissioner is to evaluate those programs and make adjustments. Maybe try something, a different approach to bring more providers or different providers in, or some type of approach to get at that problem, because what we're doing and what we have been doing is not having a high degree of success.
One more question, Mr. Right on that point. There's a really high percentage of Alaska Natives who occupy space in our facilities, and I'm just wondering about utilizing traditional cultural program kinds of things in conjunction with or in place of some of the more Western models.
Through the chair, I can. You're exactly on point. We house approximately 34 plus or minus percent of our population at any given time is made up of Alaskan Natives. And I am extremely interested. I've passed our cultural affairs coordinator, Karen Nagel, looking at a number of things regarding Alaska Native issues, one of which is exploring getting Native corporation treatment providers involved in our process. I think it's an exciting thing that we can get into, and it meets both of our needs, and it meets the needs of the Alaska Native people that are in our correctional facilities. If we can what we're doing right now does not work, sir. That's what I can tell you. We need to try something different. And I am open to, I think you'll find this administration is open to doing just about anything it can do to address this problem.
We can talk.
I look forward to that, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yep.
Continue on, Mark.
Okay, the Division of Community Corrections, as it was formerly called, and we're now referring to it as the Division of Probation Parole, which I think is a little clearer to the public, staffs field offices in most of the major cities and towns around the state. Those offices are staffed by probation officers at the 1, 2, and 3 level that supervise prisoners that have been generally that have served a sentence and are released into some type of supervision. On page 3 of the handout, I've got some at the top. I've got some rough standards from that were produced by the American Correctional Association on what an ideal caseload for a probation officer should be. And it makes mention of the fact that with no pre-sentence reports being written, the ideal caseload should be around 70 to 75. What that refers to is under the, in Alaska, it's a requirement when someone is being sentenced on a felony that a what's called a pre-sentence report be written. It includes information that's not generally admitted at court. It gives the sentencing judge a much more well-rounded picture of who that prisoner is, what kind of background they have, what kind of education, a lot more in-depth information about the offense, victim information, that kind of thing. And those reports get lengthy, and so that's why it's taken into consideration here. There are standards, the ACA standards note that when probation officers are charged with writing 1 to 2 reports a month, their caseload shouldn't exceed 60 to 65. And then it finishes off noting that probation officers with what are called specialized caseloads should not exceed 35 to 50. A specialized caseload would be, we operate 2 offices that have got those in place, Anchorage and Fairbanks. They have a mental health special caseload and then a sex offender treatment special caseload. We also operate the Wellness Court in Anchorage, and that's a 2 probation officers that handle that program. So with all that in mind, I just kind of run down the field offices here. We've got the caseload for the regular probation officers in the office, and you kind of see that we're teetering at or above those limits in many of our offices. In Southeast, we seem to be right in line or slightly below those standards, just to give you an idea of what we're looking at. The Division of Probation and Parole also supervises the victim unit that we were talking about just a moment ago, and it also supervises what's called the Interstate Compact Unit. That's a unit that manages agreements between the states when prisoners from Alaska, for example, want to transfer to Washington State or California. Each of our states that's a member of the Interstate Compact Agreement have set standards up whereby those prisoners can be transferred and managed by probation officers in the other states. So that's kind of how that works. Just a little bit about budget here, very small as you can see. Our FY 2003 budget is $180 million, $762,000. That's divided into 2 budget review units. Years ago we had, in an attempt to get a control on our budget, we split the whole department up into a multitude of budget review units. It was recombined into just 2 again, apparently last year as I understand it. To make it easier to shift money between the various components, particularly in our administration and operations side. Those 2 budget review units are administration and operations. That covers all of our facilities, probation, parole, all those type of things at the commissioner's office. The other budget review unit covers the budget associated with our community rehabilitation center, or our community residential centers, the halfway houses. We operate 11 halfway houses in the state under contract to 3 different contractors. 9 are run by Cornell Corrections, 1 is run by TMJ Western in Anchorage, and the last one is run by Gaston Human Services here in Juneau. Just some information about our prisoner population. As of about a week ago, 10 days ago, we had 3,100 prisoners incarcerated in our facilities in the state, and this hasn't changed that significantly in the time since then. For some reason, we've been running at about 98% capacity this year, which is unseasonably low. We're normally over capacity. It could be due to the position of the moon and the stars. I don't know. I think it's the weather probably. It's we've had an unseasonably warm winter all over the state, and I just think it's kept people out of prison. I really don't know how to explain it. We currently have just over 600 prisoners incarcerated at our contract facility outside of Phoenix, Arizona. We've got an additional 21 prisoners at other out-of-state facilities. That's some of those are special medical cases. Others are prisoners that have extreme separatee issues with prisoners in our facility, our in-state facilities, and our out-of-state facilities. Separatees it's a problem in a system as small as this. You have these long-term prisoners that spend a lot of time together, and sometimes we just have to separate them out. So that's how we have to do that, just to maintain order.
Okay, hold on just a second, Mark. Representative Jewell has a question.
Yep. Two quick questions. One is, when I saw this Florence Center in Arizona, I'm wondering when that contract is up. And the other question that I wanted to ask you about your budget briefly is the impact on your department if you had to take either a 5% or 10% reduction in your budget. And the impact
Through the chair, to the first part of your question, that contract is up for negotiation. It ends in June 30th of this year, and we're starting that process.
We have an option for a one-year renewal through the chair and another four-month renewal at the end of that. But we could go into renegotiations this year, or we can do an automatic extension up to October 2004.
Through the chair, to the second part of your question, I speak a little bit about, at the end of this document, about the budget situation we've taken over at the transition, and I can tell you that a 5% or 10% reduction, either one of those would be tough. Would be tough for us. We're a department that's very heavy in general fund spending, and much of that involves personnel costs, and it would be tough. We can give you some details in the subcommittee as we move through that. I think that you'll find it illuminating. So I hope.
Thank you.
We have 170 prisoners on electronic monitoring. In our 11 halfway houses, we've got 703 prisoners. And then the Division of Probation and Parole is currently supervising 4,700 prisoners. So it's a large amount.
President Stevens has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just want to ask you about the electronic monitoring. That seems like a pretty effective and inexpensive way, but I may be wrong on that, but to do the job. Is that something you see using more of in the future? What are your plans in electronic monitoring?
Well, through the chair, it is cost effective. The other part of that is that the prisoners pay for the majority of those numbers. Prisoners are paying a fee to be on that program. it does have some issues. Technology. We're all quick to grasp onto solutions, and the thing that I try to convey to people when I talk about electronic monitoring is that it does not actually keep anybody from doing anything. We generally know where they are, but it's not a cure-all solution by any means. Prisoners can. Having said that, our success with this program is generally pretty good to date. I think we need to be cautious in expanding it, but use it more than we are now.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman. So you think it could be expanded, and you think that there's additional prisoners that could be...
Through the chair, I think there's room for it. But again, I think we just need to be careful. These devices can be removed very easily. And if we discover that a prisoner's out of place, we don't know where they are. It's not a GPS type of tracking system.
Mm-hmm.
So... it would follow the prisoner around. I would like to get to a point where we have something like that, because I think that would have a lot more utility. But right now, basically, there are a couple of different kinds of systems that are in use. One of them is a proximity system, so that they get beyond a certain range from the telephone at the residence, if they're on house arrest, for example, then we get an alarm.